Well, good morning. How are you? How have you been? Where have you been? It is very, very nice to talk to you all on this Tuesday morning, the 17th of June, which just happens to be my wife's birthday.
Happy birthday, my
dear wife, Kelly. And what better day to go back to the show? We have been on hiatus while the fun drive has gone on, and we kept on saying to you, give us just a little bit more, and we'll get back to regular programming. And you did, and here we are. We are back, and here is the regular programming. Here it is. This is it. It doesn't get better than this.
Wow, talk about pressure.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people, Jim and I were talking about this just before we went on, but a lot of people on the phone saying, hell yeah, I'm missing my panel. I need my panel. I want my panel. So here we are, and we're very excited. We have a great panel. We have a lot to discuss. I'm going to do something a little unusual this morning, and then we'll get back into the crux of the day and talk about what's going on. Let me introduce everybody. Before I do that, though, seriously, thank you so much for your love and your generosity and your embrace of this radio station. It was. It's a tough time. It's a weird time. It's we're up against funding cuts and there's all kinds of swirling issues going around, many of which we'll talk about today. And the fact that you were there and you were engaged and you were with us, and we had wonderful community partnerships, and we helped a lot of people, and it all came together, and we just, from the bottom of our hearts, everyone here just wants to thank you. We want to thank the volunteers. We want to thank everyone who gave, all of our sustaining members, all of our new members. The volunteers were outstanding. To everybody on this panel who was just waiting every day for an email that said, oh, I'm sorry, you're not on tomorrow. just everybody, thank you so, so very much. And it's wonderful to be back. And we look forward to the next 4 months uninterrupted. So here we go. Let me introduce the group to you and we'll get started. Jim Henler is here, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Good morning, Jim. How are you? Jim, I will say, kudos to Jim. Not, and this isn't to make you all look
kudos.
Bad.
Kudos.
This isn't bad. This is,
although we do feel bad, when you say it, but go ahead.
But Jim and Teresa Bourgeois, like, here every day. Like, just boom. And very, very nice to have you volunteer and to be there and to be a part, and we thank you very much for that. That was very sweet.
I enjoyed it. It's, you know, to actually talk one-on-one with the listeners, and, you know, some people just want to make their donation and get off the phone, but some people really want to discuss the station. And
those are the ones I like.
Think about it. Yeah. You know, you guys are up there spieling, and I'm here there. But you know, as you just said, Joe, the thing that really was amazing to me was not only how many of them, you know, called out the roundtable, but they knew us. It's like people would say, well, what's your name? And I would say it, and they're like, oh, you're the one who, and they're like, you know, I really like this one, or, you know, so-and-so, you know, how do you, I mean, but none of them were,
of that, Rich. No.
Wait. None of them were negative. No. It was always, you know, I find it so fascinating when you have, you know, this person and that person who disagree, and yet you still get a conversation that helps us see both sides. So that was good. And then one last point of personal. Yesterday was my 40th anniversary, so I just want to tell my wife.
Congratulations. You know,
very nice.
Happy anniversary. And we went out to a very nice dinner last night. They've promised that they'll return the house as collateral after we pay the bill. And
You came here on your 40th anniversary. That's very nice of you. That's very
nice. Yesterday.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's you were here yesterday, weren't you?
Actually, yesterday was the only day I wasn't. Because of the anniversary.
Very in the morning. thank you very much again. We appreciate it. Also, Rich Honan is here, corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP. Good morning, Rich. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm well. It's nice to be back. It's good to have you back, and I thank you very much for being here. The Empire Report's J.P. Miller in the house. Good morning, J.P. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you with us. And Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, longtime editor at the Daily Gazette. And Judy, good morning. How are you?
I am glad to be back.
Yes. Well, now, this is what I thought we could do. You all know the stories that that were chosen today for discussion, which are, I think, basically the obvious choices for stories today. But nonetheless, I was hoping we could just go around real quick. And if you had one, pick the story that you were upset you weren't here to talk about while we were away. Because I think there were many. It may be hard to figure out just the one, but anybody have a? We didn't practice this, so I.
You're looking at me. I would say something that I have been focused, at least in my work on Empire Report, is the end of this state legislative session here. The assembly is going to wrap up likely today. The state senate wrapped up on Friday, and also the New York City mayor's race has taken up a lot of my time and energy and enthusiasm with what has come down to a one-on-one battle between Andrew Cuomo, who we all know, and an assemblyman named Zohran Mamdani, who is a Democratic socialist. And it's a battle between a young and old Democrat in the heart of New York City, and it's going to be fascinating what happens on June 24th in terms of who wins that ranked choice voting contest.
I love that you use the word enthusiasm. That's cool. That's very good. Anyone else?
The immigration stories. I think the developments have been nonstop. I think this is a discussion our country needs to have, but some of the abuses of the federal government at this point in terms of arresting people, what the strategy is, what the tactics are. I think that needs to really be discussed because I really worry about our country, what's happening there.
So nationally, I would say the L.A. story is one I really would have liked to have discussed as it developed. And internationally, the Israel-Iran situation.
Yeah, which we'll talk about, of course, today. Rich?
Yeah, none of them. But I just like listening and hear what you guys have to say.
Yeah,
I would have. Yeah. I what I like is when I hear
Elon Musk and Trump got into a tiff.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And we didn't get to talk about it. And I feel like we were robbed.
Right. And I couldn't have talked about that one anyway.
No, I know.
But the I like hearing the stories. I like being on the panel when there's a story where I'm thinking, I just don't understand how somebody could think this way. And then I hear intelligent reasons of why people think that way. So that's kind of what
likewise,
I look forward to.
And that's hopefully what we do here. All right, let's get going and talk about what is on the docket today. We welcome your letters. If you forget how all this works, so did we. It's simple. All you have to do is write to us. It is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let us begin with the president at the G7, although he's not there anymore. Trump signed the G7 statement backing Israel and criticizing Iran after discussions with other leaders and changes to the initial draft, and then announced that he was abruptly leaving the summit to attend to the conflict between Israel and Iran. The White House announced this late Monday. Trump called for a broader de-escalation of hostilities in the Middle East in a statement with other global leaders. Trump initially declined to sign the G7 statement, but reversed his position following discussions with other leaders in the group and changes to the initial draft. That, according to a U.S. official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe the sensitive conversations. The official declined to say what changes secured Trump's sign-off, but the statement omitted language that called for both Iran and Israel to show restraint, which appeared in an earlier draft of the agreement viewed by the Washington Post. The published statement affirmed Israel's right to defend itself and called Iran the principal source of regional instability and terror. It also reiterated that Iran cannot possess a nuclear weapon, and again, that from the Washington Post. Judy.
It's difficult to ascertain what the current administration's position is on what's happening in the Middle East. Are they supporting regime change, or are we just pursuing getting rid of the nuclear weapons that Iran is trying to develop? It seems like it's back and forth. I agree with everybody that we want to de-escalate the situation in the Middle East. My whole life we've tried to do this, but at this point it seems like Israel is lobbying for regime change. And the question is, what follows? What's next? Because there's not some sort of good guy operative working in Iran that's going to come to the rescue and bring peace to the Middle East through a defanged Iran. That's my concern, and I just wish when I turn to the U.S., the president's press secretary, or I turn on the television, that I would get, as a citizen of the United States, a clearer understanding of where America stands on this.
How could you not understand it? I think Trump and his team have been nothing but clear, not just during this crisis, and I see the looks of incredulousness on the face of the panel, but not just during this crisis, but the previous crises. Yeah, he's very clear.
The eyes did sort of say,
Yeah, that they should never have a nuclear. They should never have a nuclear program. I don't think he's ever, and I don't listen to every word in the news, but I don't think Trump has ever affirmatively called for regime change. I think I thought he had gone out of his way to say, look, we're not here to impose, regime change on anybody, in other contexts as well. I think whatever can be done to get that country to not have a nuclear weapons program is what he is in favor of doing. He would have preferred, and I think he would still prefer, to do it by some kind of negotiation. And I think now he's faced with the difficult choice. But I don't think regime change was ever something that he was openly advocating.
When he was pursuing these negotiations with Iran, though, wasn't there some sort of coordination needed with the State of Israel so that they wouldn't wouldn't interrupt the effort to have a negotiation?
Yeah, and they held off for quite some time, and they've held off, if you could believe, look, I'm not in the conversations, but if you could try and parse from what's reported, it sounds like they held off for some amount of time. He gave Iran the 60 days, or there was no appreciable change in negotiations. I understand that there's different views on what the intelligence findings. The Israelis said it's days away, and the U.S. intelligence, looking at really the same information, said no, they're years away. So I understand that, but no, I think that. I think that he quietly asked the Israelis to hold off for a while. I think that the idea of them not taking out the Ayatollah, whether that's his idea or their idea, that kind of seems like the right way to go.
So, I've been paying a lot of attention to this, obviously. The role of the U.S. in this has been very, very unclear. I mean, it's clearly been a lot of stuff that's been happening out of sight. It's hard to believe Netanyahu would have gone ahead with this without at least a tacit agreement from the U.S. Trump said publicly, I didn't know about it. Privately, then later he sort of said, it's the same thing we often get out of the White House now, where you can't quite figure it out. He left the G7, quote, to deal with this situation, unquote. Yet I can find nothing he actually did when he came back except to send two messages on Truth Social, which actually somewhat contradicted each other. So, it's really hard to call it. But I did think that some of the reporting out of the G7 was very interesting, because in the past, he's usually come out of it with a very hostile reception from everyone else. And this time, I would say it was mixed. I mean, there were definitely people who said, you know, it was like a Trump who was willing to talk to them, that he actually didn't just come in and say my way or the highway. I hate to say anything nice about Trump, but, you know, it's unclear what was going on here. I mean, Canada, he had side meetings and is apparently working on the tariff issue. We don't know what the statement was before and after, but it was clear that it was signed off in a way that, you know, it's a fairly neutral statement, and he signed off on it. So it seems like somebody has convinced him that the international world is something that he needs to at least be aware of.
JP, we got about a minute and a half.
So there is a battle within, I think, the Trump White House right now, which is, do they go and help the Israelis dismantle the nuclear facility in Fordo, which if you read the New York Times this morning, they say that only the United States has the capability to do that. Israelis do not have the bombs nor the planes to do that. And so Trump is in a unique position in that he ran on an anti-interventionalist foreign policy platform that is different than Republicans have run on over the last 30 years. He also is very close to Netanyahu and Israel and the Jewish community in the United States. So those seem to be two key groups for him, and he has to make this decision, which is super important. And there are repercussions, which, you know, we're not in those security briefings, so we don't know what repercussions he's being warned about. And Iran, of course, we've been hearing about their nuclear ambitions for 30 years. It's amazing to me that they haven't put together a nuclear bomb. But I think that it's very possible that Trump himself doesn't know which way he's going to go at this fork in the road, whether he's going to help dismantle the nuclear facilities militarily in Fordo, or whether he is going to tell the Israelis, you have my blessing. You have my blessing to do what you want, but we at this time are not going to be involved.
Yeah. And I think that's what he went home to do. I think that discussion is what he left
we'll
the G7.
We'll give you
do.
The last word. We'll be right back. Just so you know, the music that we're playing this morning is artists performing at Green River Fest this weekend in Greenfield, Massachusetts. You can find out more about their lineup by going to their website, greenriverfestival.com. You can hear individual songs that we have been playing this morning on our playlist, which is available at wamc.org/roundtable. All right. And then we'll go to your questions, of course, anything that is on your mind. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Did I cut you off, JP, or were you?
I was about my whole thought.
And then Rich?
That was my whole thought.
All right. Anybody want to add anything before we go to listener letters? All right. Haven't been on in 2 weeks. You need have more to say. Diane said the bottom line is that Trump wants the Nobel Prize for Peace so badly that he will do whatever he thinks will get him this. Well, that seems cynical, but
if that's true, so what? That he'll do anything to get
the idea is peace. Yeah, that's a good point, Rich. But yes,
he could join Yasser Arafat, right, with other Nobel Peace Prize winners.
Go ahead.
Well, my concern would be that he would sell out Ukraine and Zelensky, for the sake of a fake peace. There are other nefarious ways maybe to get a Nobel Prize, a prize for peace. I agree it's a noble crusade on his part, been incredibly unsuccessful so far. I thought there'd be no wars when Donald Trump was elected. You know, he'd be such a powerful person, there'd be no wars. But apparently there's a war in the Middle East at this point, and a continuing war in Ukraine.
Yeah, neither of which, both of which didn't happen on his watch.
You mean what's happened in the Middle East right now is not on his watch?
What's happened in...
Right now and what's happening in Iran is not in his watch?
Well, it's an outgrowth of what happened in October.
The last few things
Yeah. Everything's an outgrowth of things that happened 100 years ago as well.
Well, not that many years ago. I think a lot of this is an outgrowth of what happened when, you know, Barack Obama tried really hard to... You know, do a deal with Iran, and we're still paying the price for that.
Okay, so on that we go to this letter, which just proves that the listeners have just been percolating while we've been away. Andrew says, "Didn't we have a deal limiting nuclear development in Iran? What idiot president got rid of that because a black guy signed it? Are your memories really that shot?" asks Andrew.
And does anybody really need to point out that deal was not a deal, and that deal probably paved the way for them to get more updated centrifuges than they had before. And that deal did nothing to stop them from being the worldwide sponsor of terrorism. And we are, I'll stand by my statement, we're still paying for that deal, as well as the relaxation of sanctions against Iran during the Jill Biden administration, but whatever administration was in place last, which was also not helpful to this process.
We just got to shake our heads here.
Yeah, I'll simply say I don't agree, but okay. And leave it like that.
Vincent writes, it should be noted that Netanyahu and company were very much against the nuclear deal that Obama had put together with Iran and have done everything possible since then to diminish the possibility of it being resurrected. Are we really sanctioning the bombing of other countries and killing their leaders every time we disagree with them and their ideology? That from Vincent.
This one I actually think is different, and I may even end up agreeing with Rich on this. We'll see. But, you know, several months ago, before the Trump administration, I was listening to one of the many sources I listened to on this, and they were saying that, you know, actually one of the things they believed the Trump administration was going to try very hard to establish was not so much regime change, but you have a population in Iran who do not particularly like their government. They've had lots of big demonstrations of things and felt that you now had some of the other countries there, the Saudi Arabias, and who would not get involved in an Israel-Iran contest. And also that Trump has now gone out of his way to make deals with a lot of those countries. So in fact, the thing that could have blown up into a Mideast-wide conflict seems much less likely to do so. It now becomes much more of a two-country and some supporting actors. You still have the Gaza situation. Hezbollah is saying, you know, we're going to take our revenge, but Hezbollah was very heavily...
degraded.
I don't know what word to
degraded.
Use. Disarmed, degraded. Yeah. Degraded is the better word, yeah. So, you know, it's really been a kind of tacit relationship between the U.S. and Israel on the Iran and the North. And then you had, you know, sort of Syria taking care of itself. You have Lebanon virtually a non-player at the moment. So, you know, it seemed like a lot of people were saying that we know that you're going to see Israel backed by the U.S. probably tacitly going in and trying to not so much do regime change, but to reduce the threat of Iran as that sponsor of terrorism around the arc of the region.
Anybody else?
Well, and specifically the nuclear facility, you know, they've taken out, according to reports, like the top 9 or 10 nuclear scientists in Iran. And I do think that going forward, you know, we talk about previous deals, even going forward, I don't understand how the United States, you know, negotiates with Iran on this in terms of believing what they say. You know, they are you know, they support terrorists. You'd say, you know, they're terrorists. How do you negotiate with a terrorist? I would imagine, you know, they say that they want IAEA inspectors to go into Fordo to make sure that they dismantle their facility there. But why is Iran, who is going to spend tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, building this facility, going to go and dismantle it? You know, what I would want them to have Iran say, we're moving all of our people out and you can bomb it on your own and destroy it yourself. I don't understand how a deal is going to be reached going forward where the United States or Israel has a confidence that they are going to abandon their nuclear ambitions, which they've been working on for at least the past 30 or 40 years.
Rachel writes to us and says, please do not characterize Trump as being close to the Jewish people. He has made his living in this country more dangerous for Jews while using the Jewish people as an excuse to stomp civil rights of others. Also, he loves him some white supremacists. That from...
you know, I see Rich shaking his head, and I'm nodding.
I don't even know why you read that crap, Joe. I really don't.
So, you know what, Rich? I've been both in the classified world and the unclassified world watching this stuff. And the white supremacist movement has grown significantly during the two Trump administrations and much less in between. Now, cause, effect, we can get into a lot of conversation, but there has been, again, at least tacit support. I mean, a lot of the people who were pardoned for January 6th were very clearly anti-Jewish. And so, you know, I mean, it's you can argue a lot of different ways on this, but I think to say that Trump has been a friend of the Jews is not fair. To say that Trump has a relationship with Netanyahu in Israel is a different statement.
Yeah, I don't think there's as much daylight between being, and I know people on the left try to say that there is. I don't think there's as much daylight between being a friend of Israel and being a friend of the Jewish people as those on the far left would have us believe. I think that being a friend of Israel is being a friend to the Jewish people. And when I look at what the Biden and Obama administrations did, not only their antipathy towards Israel, but their tolerance of what I consider to be viciously anti-Semitic rhetoric throughout academic institutions in which they had a great degree of power. I don't see how you could. I think Trump is much more friendly to not only Israel, but to the Jewish people than certainly the Biden administration ever was.
Yeah.
And when I was characterizing it, it was just that he views that as a constituency of his, right? He has supporters who are pro-Israel and who are Jewish. And not to say that he's, to characterize him as a friend or foe, but I think he views that as a constituency of his. Would you say that's fair?
I don't think I disagree with that, yeah. But I will tell you, as president of a synagogue, we went from balanced budgets to major, major fundraising to be able to afford the security we need that, you know, was partly because of Gaza, but was a lot because of how that's played out over time. And the U.S. could have made significantly different decisions, both under Biden and Trump, but especially in the past few months, where I think things started moving in positive directions. And then it's been move, stop, two steps forward, one step back. I mean, it's a terrible situation for everybody. And I think Trump, largely by ignoring it in public, has made it worse.
Will writes to us and says, let's not be so short-sighted to blame the current Iran crisis on President Obama. We've been choosing the wrong course of action for at least 60 years in Iran. Both Democrats and Republicans share the blame. That from Will. And we're going to go to a break, but I'm just going to end with my favorite letter of the day, which is, are you on today? I'm glad we're making an impression. We'll be back right after this.
garage for two cars to park in, or a lot of room for storage if you've just got one.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. It's the 17th of June, and we are delighted that we are back from Fun Drive Land. And here we are. We welcome you, and it is really good to be back in the saddle. And we thank you very much for being with us. All right. Let's see. We are going to go we're going to change subjects, if that's okay. We're going to go to the budget bill and the opposition to that, even within the GOP, and talk a little bit about that, because that has been a story that has been festering, I think, while we have been away. And I'm going to start with a poll, a Senate Republicans race to pass President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act. A plurality of Americans oppose the sweeping tax and spending legislation, with mixed opinions on specific provisions and concerns about its impact on the national debt and Medicaid. That, according to a Washington Post Ipsos poll conducted earlier this month. Overall, 42% of Americans oppose the bill changing tax spending and Medicaid policies that narrowly passed in May by the Republican-controlled U.S. House of Representatives, compared with 23% of Americans who support the bill. And then there is the mighty, ever mighty 34% who have no opinion whatsoever. Support among Republicans is higher, with 49% who say they support the bill, compared to 13% who oppose, 30% who say they have no opinion whatsoever. Democrats strongly oppose the bill, with about three-quarters of Democrats against it. Independents also oppose it 40% to 17%, while about 4 in 10 independents have no opinion on the bill. Now, meanwhile, Senate Republicans have scrambled to emphasize the bill's economic benefits to voters and pass their version of it by Trump's deadline of the 4th of July. But while most people are not very aware of the legislation, and among those who have not heard about the bill, those who have say it's unpopular. About two-thirds of the public said that they have heard either little or nothing about the bill. Those who have heard a great deal or a good amount about it oppose it by roughly a 2-to-1 margin. Judy.
Yeah, the American public really isn't paying attention to this very, very much. And if you put generic questions to them, they will side in the favor of being generous and helpful to their fellow Americans. I think these polls served. They're trying to move the needle one way or the other when it comes to what's going to happen at the congressional level. What I have found fascinating about this whole discussion is whether or not this bill will generate increased economic activity, which will in turn generate increased government revenue, which will in fact reduce the deficit. I think economists are clearly split on whether or not this is actually true. I've heard Mike Johnson advocate for this position that, no, we are not going to increase the deficit because what we are doing will stimulate economic activity, will in turn, you know, just like the tariffs, which in fact are bringing a lot of revenue as an aside into the Treasury. So that's clearly where, you know, the rubber hits the road, whether or not people will believe that that happens. I tried to figure out if there's a – I asked AI thinks it will, but there are clearly other opinions out there.
The real quick, just to talk a little bit about what where things stand on the Senate bill. Republicans in the Senate released legislation on Monday that would cut Medicaid far more aggressively than would the House pass bill to deliver President Trump's domestic agenda, while also salvaging or slowing the elimination of some clean energy tax credits. The measure sets up a fight among Republicans over their marquee policy package. Jim Henler.
Well, you know what? What's interesting for us New Yorkers is what may come down to a really, really significant issue. I suspect it will eventually be negotiated out. But right now, one of the big cuts in the Senate bill is to remove the salt tax increase. So or decrease, I guess, technically. So right now, it's $10,000 that you pay in your state taxes can be taken off. The House bill took that up to 40%. And
based on New York
40,000.
Republican congressman who...
Yes, it was Stefanik, in fact, who was and to a very large degree. And a lot of the other New Yorkers. I mean, it passed by one vote, and you had five or six New Yorkers who said that was their key issue. Now you have
and
the
one
Senate.
New Yorker was asleep for the vote, Garbarino. But go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
That's great. But the key is that the Senate taking that out and having a one-vote majority in the House, that's going to be something that means this is not going to go. It's not going to be reconciled by the House just saying, sure, we'll go along with what the Senate did. And I think that's going to make for this to drag on for a very long time.
The other thing, I think a big reason that it is so unpopular is not only, so you're going to have near universal opposition on the Democratic side of a bill that cuts Medicaid and Medicare. You're also going to get now, because of Elon Musk's split with Donald Trump, you're also now getting a significant part of the Republican MAGA base going against this bill because it's going to add $2 trillion to the deficit. And it's not cutting enough. And it is, at the same time, it's increasing spending. It's also cutting taxes. And Judy, your point of the economists saying, well, you know, now we're gonna cut taxes and there's going to be all this economic growth. They've been giving us that argument each time that Republicans hold the House, the Senate, and the White House, and they do this program of we're going to cut taxes and we're going to increase spending at the same time. They always give us the same line of, oh, the increased economic activity, our economy is going to be growing at 7-8% a year. Everything's going to be taken care of, is obviously hogwash and ridiculous. And so this bill, Jim, your point too of the SALT tax deduction, that's a no-go for the Republican members of Congress in New York. They are not going to vote for that, and they can't then pass the the bill on the House side when it comes to conference. So this is turning into a I would call it an albatross around the White House, and they have very little control over to how this is being negotiated, and are going to be saddled with, in my view, no matter how this comes out, significant losses in the House and the Senate in the midterms, which is going to derail President Trump's last 2 years in office.
You know, I think you're right, and I think the other thing that's very different in this administration from the last one, right, is partly because of Biden's many years in the House and Senate. But Biden would have had his people down there in the negotiations helping push it through. Trump has alienated a fair number of senators. And when we get to the story about Minnesota, we're going to see today another whole chunk of people who are. So I think his general opinion that Congress doesn't really matter and, you know, I'm going to push them to change things they approved years ago, like the PBS and NPR appropriations. I don't think you see the White House having a lot of impact on being able to help solve these problems. So I think it's really going to become a very internal fight in the House and the Senate. And, you know, I think the one organization that used to be able to really help solve these things has pretty much taken itself out, which is the White House.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I just, it's hard. I don't know that I disagree with any of that, although I think that what Trump has tried to do this time as opposed to last time is let the House run the House, let the Senate run the Senate. He certainly makes his displeasure known, often in a not overly helpful way, when somebody has the temerity to slow down his agenda. It's just weird to think that this whole thing might founder on the rocks of the SALT tax, you know, the state and local tax, which I just don't understand how a conservative can say, yeah, I want a $40,000 tax deduction because my state overspends on taxes. Yeah, I just but other people are, but you guys are going to have to take a cut, whether it's, I mean, that's a campaign ad that writes itself, right? You know, we're going to give, you know, $30,000 more to people who are, you know, if you have $40,000 worth of, say, real estate taxes, you're living pretty large.
Yeah.
Right. It's not that $40,000 doesn't come off the top of their tax bills.
Right.
It's the whatever 6 or 7% of that $40,000, which comes out to, for someone who has that, is paying that kind of a tax bill, significant means, and doesn't matter, in my view, that much to their overall tax bill that year.
Yeah. And you kind of wonder, when is Mike Johnson, or when is somebody going to sit down with a Lawler, for example, or even an Elise Stefanik, and say, okay, do the math. The percentage that your constituents would save on this, on an increased SALT deduction versus the percentage they're going to have to pay when these tax, when the tax cuts expire, right? I mean, they're going to pay so much more money if they allow this to happen. Oh. I can't believe somebody has not yet made that argument.
So, Rich, you know, I think what it comes down to...
Less than a minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, but real quick, you know, when I pay my taxes now, I get a refund from the federal government and then write a check to the state, right? And I think that, to most people, is what this issue is. They don't understand where the dollars are and how many dollars, and that, you know, that federal one would go down if this was fixed right and things like that. I think it's, you know, it really is just like people going into the grocery store and saying, eggs are too expensive, inflation is bad, right? I think the SALT is one of those things where people feel it because it changes. I used to get a refund from both, now I don't, kind of thing. And you have, and it hits middle income. I mean, it hits between the 100 and, you know, 300 or 400. So that is a fairly big population.
I don't know. We
Joe's going to take exception with that being middle.
No, I don't know. I just, as a couple who have no children, I mean, we just write checks to everybody.
Yeah. So I feel the same way.
Yeah. All right. We'll take a break and we'll be back right after this.
You come to me on a fault line deep inside a gold mine, hovering like a moth. I lose a bit of myself. Laying out eggshells.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. A couple of letters and then we'll move on to other topics. Why do people, ask Polly, why do people insist on thinking that the president has a long-term plan considering his increasingly erratic behavior on anything involving the government? Then... there is Richard. If someone is paying $40,000 in taxes, I can assure you they are not living large. They are trying to scrape by. The SALT deduction was a tradition for many, many years, and the Republicans politicized it. And that is from Richard.
I will say that we were talking off air, and people here were pointing out that, you know, there are people who have just lived in houses for 40 years, and, you know, when, you know, middle class people, and they bought the house, now they've paid it off and property values have increased over that time, and they're suddenly paying $40,000 in taxes for, you know, with an income that really never contemplated that. So I that does make sense. I do believe that.
All right, let's change topics and move on. And one of the stories that, of course, happened over the weekend and that we would have probably led with yesterday, but we'll continue to talk about today, and that is the killings in Minnesota. And what we know of what happened there, the man accused of assassinating one state lawmaker in Minnesota and shooting another could face the federal death penalty. He tried to attack two other officials, according to prosecutors, and had many more on a hit list. The suspect planned to quote, inflict fear with wider killing spree, according to prosecutors. The suspect, 57-year-old Vance Bolter. My screen just went dead. Okay. The man accused of killing a Minnesota lawmaker and wounding another in a campaign to, quote, inflict fear, made a first appearance in federal court, as the authority described what they said were plans to carry out this killing spree. Vance Bolter faces federal murder charges in the attack that killed a Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband. Those charges could allow for the death penalty. This was a political assassination, which is not a word we use very often in the United States of America, said Joseph Thompson, the acting U.S. attorney for the District of Minnesota, during a news conference in Minneapolis. Mr. Bolter was being held at the Hennepin County Jail in downtown Minneapolis in his court appearance on Monday. He was alert and direct, made no eye contact with members of the public. The judge set a preliminary hearing for June 27th. Mr. Bolter has already been charged by state prosecutors with two counts of second-degree murder for the fatal shootings of Representatives Melissa Hortman and her husband, Mark, and two counts of attempted second-degree murder for shooting and wounding State Senator John Hoffman and his wife, Yvette. And this is, of course, a story that goes on as we talk about political violence and where we are in our country, and then, of course, the conversation that always comes up in this, which is about guns and the use of them in such tragedies.
Yeah, incredibly alarming. I think we need to recognize the fact that there is an increasing amount of political violence. I mean, there was the arson at Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania's house. There was the shootings outside the Irish, the Jewish museum in Washington. You had the, several years ago now, but you had the Steve Scalise shooting at the ball field. I mean, I think we need to tone it down. I think leaders need to come out and say this is unacceptable. This is, we do not condone this. We need to stop using inflammatory words you don't refer to people as vermin or scum.
I'm sorry, that's new scum. Go ahead.
But, there's a tendency to go out and, you know, was a person a registered Republican or a registered Democrat? I don't want to do any of that. I want all of our leaders to come together and denounce political violence.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
All violence.
Right,
yeah,
right.
But particularly political, yeah.
Good point.
As well, and add to that the, I'm going to get the word wrong, show my age, the swatting incidents.
Yeah.
Yeah, right, where they're calling, that happened to some people here, right, where they call the police to the house. They say, and the police come running in thinking there's like an armed invasion going on or something like that. Is that?
Yeah,
is that the word?
I think you're using that correctly.
So, I agree with Judy, and I wish it was the truth because, Mike Lee came out with just a hideous set of tweets. Trump today says he's just absolutely not going to call Waltz. In the previous administration, anytime something like this happened, Biden, if he didn't call, at least if he didn't show up, he at least called. I cannot find on the record any Republican who has condemned this shooting. I have seen people on some of the conservative news stations making fun of Waltz because he had at some point in the past appointed this guy to something, some panel or something. I mean, it's stunning to me because this is such a hate crime. It's such an obvious hate crime. It's one that I can't imagine anyone condoning, and they're not condoning it, but what they're doing is they're not criticizing it. And
that's
unbelievable. It just shows how bad the Democratic-Republican split has become that you can't even show sympathy for a colleague without generating political kickback.
In the president's defense, in his initial statement via Truth Social, he did condemn political violence, I think. But in that same post, he did say he wasn't going to call Waltz. I mean, it wasn't the Waltz comment was not standalone. It was part of a general statement in which he did come out and say something that I wanted him to say about this was unacceptable.
And I do see this as something that, you know, they've been talking just over the last couple of days about this being 10 years since Trump came down that escalator and entered into our political life. And I do think that since he came on the scene, that people on both the left and the right, instead of saying we disagree about these issues or I disagree about this person on these issues, both the left and the right say that people on the other side are bad people. They are irredeemable people. They are backwards in their thinking and that they're bad people. And that is something that we need to, in my view, I agree with you, Judy, which is tone down the rhetoric. And what happens inevitably with these situations is that's not what happens. Elected officials like Mike Lee and like others use incidents like this to not to heal and to come together. They use incidents like this to pour more fuel on the fire.
Just to give some context as to Mike Lee and his actions, the senator, Republican from Utah, posted a pair of messages that were mocking the attack. This is what happens when Marxists don't get their way, Mr. Lee wrote on Sunday on his X account, a message accompanied by photographs of the suspect released by law enforcement officials. An hour later, in a second post showing the suspect, Mr. Lee wrote, "Nightmare on Waltz Street," in an apparent reference to the Democratic governor of the state, Tim Waltz.
And what was the meaning? What?
Well, I will say that.
I mean, how does he link
Waltz, the last name Waltz?
No. I get the misspelled pun.
Apparently,
I get the pun. I just. Where is he placing the Waltz responsibility? I'm not getting that leap in
meaning,
logic.
Meaning that the nightmare is on his watch, if you will, on his street, on his in his. Again, John Stewart last night was talking about this, and he said, comedically, that's really bad of saying. First of all, he condemned it and said it was awful, John Stewart, and then said, you know, like. The obvious would have been the wolf on Wall Street.
Right.
Yeah.
And the dissemination of lies about the shooting has been rampant on right-wing social media. I mean, I hesitate to even talk about it, but this is a classic example of spreading lies. You know are lies. You're told they're lies, but you repost them anyway. If you're out there on social media and you see one of these lies, either respond to it and correct it, but definitely don't repost it.
Joe, I do need to apologize for one thing. I do see now that Mike Johnson and John Thune both came out with statements that said political violence has no place in our nation. So, you know, they said none of the Republicans did it, at least a few had the made
an attempt.
I'd call it fairly moderate statements, but at least they tried. And the Republican the Republican Party in Minnesota did condemn it, but again, that took a little while.
You know, this is one person who, you know, did some horrible things. But the reason that we talk about political rhetoric in general is it's that kind of heightened political rhetoric that dehumanizes people, that can trigger this kind of thing. These are the kind of people we're especially worried about, these lone wolves. They're operating on their own. There's no indication that this is any kind of conspiracy. But again, We're a nation of millions and millions of people, and there are going to be people who will seize upon what is being said, especially by people in power, and say, okay, it's all right to do this. I mean, President Trump pardoned all those January 6 people. Okay, maybe political violence is all right. And so those are the kinds of signals that people who are very susceptible to this can seize upon and act.
It's also super concerning because other than the president and I think like this the Supreme Court justices, members of the United States Senate, governors, members of Congress, state senators, state reps, none of them have sufficient security such as to stop a would-be assassin. Right. The only people that have that come close to that is the President of the United States and maybe the Supreme Court justices. But you meet elected officials, they may have a couple of state police driving them around, and not to say that those state police don't do a great job, but elected officials throughout our country are all very open and susceptible to a would-be assassin or attacker.
And we want people to run for office, and this is obviously discouraging to this. We want real people to run, people who Mitt Romney was rich and could afford his own security, but he said the cost of security is one of the reasons he chose not to run for re-election. I mean, among many reasons, but it's a real issue.
I don't – tell me if this is a leap bridge.
Okay.
But when we were talking earlier about stories that we didn't get to because we were away, the Senator Alex Padilla story, too, of having a United States senator walk into a press conference from the Director of Homeland Security and to be forcibly removed, handcuffed, brought to the ground, dragged out. I mean, that... Like, doesn't this fit into this whole thing about you can't put up with someone who is going to say anything that disagrees with what are saying?
I think his behavior is more in line with what is what you guys are talking about.
Meaning rushing in.
I guess I have to preface everything by saying I only know about this from the news, right?
Yeah, you know
what I mean?
Which
these days, you kind of have to say that. You know, I only know, and I don't know if I'll call it the news. I know this from what I saw on TV, okay?
Yeah.
But what I saw...
See, we learned from the radio, but go ahead.
Well, whatever.
But you need the visual in this case.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Because what I saw was a guy, and, you know, shame on me, I don't know what Alex Padilla looks like.
Yeah.
Okay. But I saw a guy not dressed in a suit, not even wearing that I could see like one of the big like ID badges that people like that official people will wear like at an event. But right? And then
I mean to your point,
storms into a press conference and starts yelling at somebody and then won't shut up. That's how a United States senator acts? That's exactly the kind of stuff that has been normalized. That should not be.
Okay, so two things. One, where I agree with you, is that members of the House and Senate will wear a Secret Service button on their lapel, and that is
I didn't see that,
and that is this. He wasn't wearing it.
Oh,
he was not wearing it.
All right.
So that was one of the things that they said that would not have happened had he been wearing that.
So you mean the security people would have
seen that he was a member of the House or Senate, and someone that they would be.
Less worried
ultimately
about.
Protecting.
Yeah.
You know, that would be their job to protect as opposed to someone to go after. So that's one thing. The other thing is, and there seems to be some back and forth on this, but he did identify, and this is where
I heard him say it.
He identified himself as, and by the way, I mean, he's in California. He's the United States Senator of California. I think most people, when he walked in, knew who he was.
Really?
He also,
you know him by
he
face?
Also, he also,
I don't know him by face.
Well, I'm not in California.
So he also, you know, Rich, what's interesting is I've seen that news cover. So, usually the night before I go on this show, I watch two or three different channels, right?
So do I. Gritting my teeth, but so do I.
Me too, but probably on the other ones. But The one where he comes in shouting.
He didn't say the news. He was just watching.
It's a few minutes.
Cuts out the very beginning where he does walk in. He does say, you know, I have a question I want to ask about. I mean, he is, you know, I'll say belligerent, but not as belligerent as when they start trying to pull him out, which is where most of the things I saw on the more conservative media started the video. So if you see him from the very beginning, the other thing is to get into the building, he had to identify himself to be up on that floor, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there was a long story about what it takes to get in there.
But that's the problem, right? So. And again, maybe he's just – he's that famous guy that everybody should know him by face. But, you know, but even if not,
the minute he says, I am a senator, you would expect them to –
I'm not being flip here. This guy was dressed as a cop.
Right.
They identified himself as a cop. I think his behavior was inconsistent with that I think would still expect from a United States senator. I understand the standards have gone down.
I agree with Rich that I thought that his entrance, I'm not sure it rises to the level of belligerent, but it was intrusive. But in his defense, he says he had been trying to get a meeting with Noam for weeks unsuccessfully and had been unable to get answers to his questions. I think what happened bringing him out into the hallway and handcuffing him was way over. And I think certainly not everybody in the room would recognize him, but Kristi Noem, you think, would have. Or have tried to intervene and stop it. And that's maybe she was so nervous about answering questions, but she didn't really take a good hard look. But I would have thought she would have known and put a stop to this.
She's also one of the administration personnel who allegedly is under the most amount of security threats and has the most amount of additional security around her. Don't know if that's true, but that's I've seen that report.
That's traditionally been true of the DHS leads. But that said, let's not get into the whole issue, but let me say that in any other administration, I cannot imagine Kristi Noem having been passed by the Senate as a DHS leader. The amount of... I was on the DHS advisory board for a long time. They cover 14 different agencies. They cover all sorts of things. And she just does not have the background that you need to be able to answer some of the questions that they were trying to ask.
But it's a different – I mean, obviously, that's a different issue.
Yeah, I understand. We sort of go there.
But I started by saying, is that too far of a reach? And I don't know the answer to that. I really don't. And I do. I mean, at the end, I thought it was from what I read, from what I see, there was a substantive conversation that took place between the two of them following that, and they worked out that and so at least it ended that way.
Although Padilla did kind of say afterwards that although they did have the conversation. Her answer to all of his questions was, I'll get back to you on that.
Well, but I just the whole idea of when you start, whichever side it is, when you start acting in a way that I'll call incivil, and things, especially in today's environment, things cascade really quickly, you know? I don't think that was his finest hour. Maybe it wasn't security's finest hour. Although then the next day we hear what's the thing that happened yesterday where the guy runs into the courtroom and stabs in New York City yesterday. The guy gets into a secure courthouse, right? Runs to a courthouse, stabs two of the guards pretty badly, you know, just surrounded by security. So you have to be careful everywhere in public buildings. But the point I'm trying to make is I agree with everybody. If he had raised his hand and said, you know, excuse me, Madam Secretary, I'm Senator, whatever, may I ask you a question? Now, she might have said no, okay, but he would have looked a lot better. you know, but he chose to act a certain way. They reacted a certain way, and now it's a thing, and it didn't have to be that way.
Yeah. No, I think there's, as you say, I agree with everybody. I mean, I think that's part of that
but,
case.
But again, you know, I think we're drawing false parallels to put his actions versus the Republicans who are making fun of, you know, who are making fun of Waltz and of Minnesota because
correct.
Of the shooting. I mean, that is way,
that's way,
way
worse.
Worse.
Yeah. But correct.
That's sad.
Absolutely.
But all of them are. Well, the lack of empathy, the lack of trying to work together, lack of bipartisanship, the lack of a middle. I mean, all of these things are really hurting our country on both sides in a lot of ways.
And I'll add to that, from the right-wing point of view, this whole concept that somehow your issue is more important than my issue and that therefore gives you the right to act in a certain way. You get to interrupt me. You get to shout me down. You get to close the streets. And I'm sure you could do it in both ways. But this whole idea that somehow your pain outweighs my pain as an opening gambit, that makes it very, very difficult to have effective communication.
Yeah. Joe, do I have a minute to just say, you know,
I grant you this.
Because I'm looking at the clock and I'm not quite sure where we're
break. We're about 10:35 is our hour. So
okay.
Go ahead.
So what was really interesting, and this has been duplicated several times, you know, experiments have been run where they take a piece of legislation that had bipartisan support and they present it to people who I self-identify as Republicans saying this was a Democratic.
Oh, yeah.
Thing, and then they give it to Democrats saying this was a Republican thing. And in every case, you end up with the majority opposing it if they think it was introduced by the other party. So even, you know, we're even reaching the point where people aren't even reading what things say or caring. It's become very much this us versus them mentality. And I think what we're seeing play out here is more and more and more of that. And unfortunately, I don't see an easy way that gets better anytime soon.
Just a couple of letters that we got. One is from Betsy. I don't believe my ears, panel. I guess the guards didn't believe them either when Padilla clearly said who he was, which we addressed. I mean, you can say whoever, but what? Okay. Totally unacceptable behavior by DHS with regards to the senator. And you know what he said after he was released? If they do this to me in plain sight, what do they do to those they detain out of sight? Well, I think we know that, right? I mean, we've seen that too. Just for...
Yeah, I wonder who wrote that line for him.
Wow. Okay.
Rich is back.
There's a little bit of cynicism.
Yeah, he had no idea it was going to go that way, right?
No. Well.
All right. Keep going.
Yeah, okay. And then there's
I think he's smart enough to have done it himself.
Randy writes, taking me to task for saying about the identification of this shirt. And said that he has he's wearing a U.S. Senate shirt, and where the alligator or the polo horse would go, it says U.S. Senate. My point was that there's an official badge. It's a lapel pin button that goes on that is a sign for the Secret Service.
If you remember on January 6th, there was a video footage of them taking off these pins because they didn't want to be identified.
They didn't want to be identified. Yeah. So, and no offense, but I think anybody can get a U.S. Senate shirt. I mean, I know people who wear shirts from like Cornell and Oxford, and they haven't gotten there. So, yeah. There's that. But I understand the point. I'm just, you know. Okay. Let's see. We have a minute. I disagree that both parties cranked up the hatred for each other when Trump entered the scene. It's not Democrat versus Republican. Trump emboldened the hatred violence against, quote, the other Democrat. Democrats' issues are against the MAGA movement and mentality, not the Conservative Party itself. That from Ed. My thanks to everyone on this Tuesday morning. Thank you for being back. Thank you for coming back. I didn't know if you'd all wander off, never to be seen again after our fun drive. It's wonderful to have you all back. And I say that to our panelists and to the audience. So thank you very, very much. We will return with an interview with the great Dionne Warwick right after this.